Today in New York City, there are sections of New York City that are coming back to life because why? Because the drug money that's infusing a renaissance. Parts of East New York and Queens where the Jamaicans and the rest of them, the rest of the drug gangs are pouring that money back into the community. Actually, Nixon and the Republicans finally got black capitalism, but now it's in the form of the drug economy. The drugs of the future are going to be synthetic, man-made, made in clandestine secret laboratories by high school chemists are going to be able to make money. I see it now as our drugs like ice and ecstasy and crank. These are all synthetic drugs, much more powerful and in many ways much more deadly than the natural products. It's very easy to get somebody off of drugs. You just put them in a 5-day detox or a 10-day detox, and their body is now clean of the drug.
But that's merely a medical treatment.
That's only a medical treatment, and in fact is only dealing at a symptomatic level. When you put them back in an environment where they don't have opportunity, or an environment where they have lots of stress, or an environment which where they have not been able to address a lot of the underlying emotional difficulties they have, then they're going to relapse, they're going to go back. What is it about American culture that leaves us so ripe to want to use drugs?
We return to the trenches of the war against drugs for part two of our series with New York City drug counselor Jack Schierenbeck. Right now, on Alternative Views.
Your stories make me think that there's a lot more involved in solving the drug problem than just say no, as Nancy Reagan would have it, or just lock them up and throw them in jail,
or send them to boot camp like they're talking about.
Yeah, shock incarceration camps, locking people up. Actually, lock them up fever is really sweeping the country right now. They're talking about locking up drug users, not just dealers, but drug users.
Even the casual users.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, we already have, most people are probably not aware of it, we already have more people, highest percentage of people of our population in lockup than in any other country in the world other than South Africa.
And so, there are some southern states, I think 3 or 4 southern states, that have a higher per capita lockup rate than South Africa.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So our jails are already full. And we know in places like New York, you're spending $50,000 to keep a person in jail, and yet we will not spend the money necessary to have good daycare systems, good family therapy. You talk about therapy, Doug. I'll talk to you about just drug treatment. Mm-hmm. I get people every day who come to me and say, I'm ready to give it up. I had enough. Help me. And you know, in this country, we have drug treatment, but it's a class system. There are over 5,000 treatment centers in the United States that are private treatment centers that cost anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a day. Now, you got to be well-heeled, or you better have a major medical wraparound insurance to be able to afford those treatment centers. That excludes people on Medicaid, or worse, the 37 million Americans who are working Americans, who cannot afford to have private health insurance and not eligible for Medicaid. They're locked out of our treatment centers.
I'm one.
And you're locked out. Well, fortunately, you don't have a drug problem, at least that you're owning up to, Frank. But so really, I get people all the time who want help, and I have to tell them, if they have Medicaid, well, I'm going to have to put you on a waiting list for 2 to 3 months to get you into a long-term residential treatment.
Which might be too late for...
Oh, listen, somebody's using drugs. They're ready. They're ripe. They're coming in. You put them back on the street, If they're, first of all, using needles, you got a chance they're going to share a needle with somebody, they're going to give it to their spouse, they're going to give it to a baby. The ripple effect is tremendous. We need to be giving people treatment on demand. In the end, it will even be a cost saver. But the problem in our country is that why would we give poor addicts help when we're not willing to give the poor help? I mean, Reagan was always talking about giving the deserving poor government spending. Well, everybody in our society does not see addicts as deserving poor. The most people think of addiction and drug use as a self-inflicted wound. They have only themselves to believe. I mean, I have a close relative, an in-law, who tells me she herself is the child of an alcoholic. Her father ran away from a large family when she was a small child. But she'll tell me, she says, you know, Jack, I just don't buy your argument about these addicts. You know, you're just always crying a blue streak about these addicts. I got no sympathy for them. Everybody in life has crosses to bear. You don't have to use drugs. And then I think that's the position. Most people believe that if you want to give up drugs, it's just a matter of true grit. It's just a matter of, you know, pulling up those emotional bootstraps and getting to it. And I think it's a lot. I think it's a lot more deeper than that. And we need to be providing help and services. And we, as a country, are particularly hard-hearted when it comes to drugs. I'll give you an example. We're about to spend $8.8 billion in the war on drugs. 70% of that is for law enforcement. Only 30% of it is for prevention and treatment.
And even that, a lot of it will go to bureaucracies or to programs that are ineffective and not down to the streets to really help the people that are suffering.
I work in a drug treatment agency, and I can tell you drug treatment is important, but I will also tell you that focusing on treatment is, in fact, closing the barn door after the horse is gone. We need to be thinking about effective prevention, and effective prevention is to be looking at what is the dynamics in the society which is producing so much distress that people feel the need to use drugs in the first place. One of the things I did not talk about is that when we talk about drugs, we're not aware of that a lot of people who use drugs are in one way mentally ill. A psychiatrist in Yale did a survey a few years ago of 750 addicts. In that 750 addicts, they found that 85% of them were either schizophrenics, borderline schizophrenics, manic depressives, or they suffered heavy depressive disorders. They were or had panic disorders or anxiety disorders. So in many ways, their taking of substances was an attempt to self-medicate their symptoms, because we don't really have a way for these people to deal with their problems. We don't have therapy. Therapy is really a rich man's sport in this country. You go out and you try to get a therapist outside of the University of Texas, where you might be able to get one at the student union, the hospital there, and you're not going to be able to afford it. It's $50, $60, $80, $90 a throw. And to group therapy, you can't just go once a week. You got to go 2-3 times a week. Who can afford that? So it's a class-bound treatment center we have, and we're also not looking at the root causes of the addiction in the first place.
Well, that it seems from what you're saying that there are basically three reasons because people take drugs. One is for excitement, like you say. Another is for escape. And the third is to lessen emotional pain. You flip those upside down and say this spotlights a total societal disorder, where why do people need excitement? Are most of everybody's lives boring? Is their work life boring? Is their family life boring? And what are they escaping from? Why do they need escape? And then the pain. What causes the pain that people are trying to escape?
Well, Frank, you old radical, you. I mean, that's exactly the thing. What we talked about before is that, in fact, drugs, in some measure, meet legitimate needs that people have. You know, we talk about this. You know, you listen to people like Bill Bennett say, well, this is a hedonistic society. This is a pleasure-oriented society. This is a do-your-own-thing society. Frankly, this is a society which, in fact, has its nose to the grindstone. We now have families where there has to be two paychecks. Everybody's out working. Everybody is goal-oriented. It's, you know, like the commercial says, where it absolutely positively has to be there overnight. This is a production-oriented society. Very work, work, work. I mean, where we get pleasure, actually we get pleasure in the form of commodities. Commodities in the form of food, in the forms of things that are part of our passive spectator culture. And why are we passive? Most of us come home dead beat, our ass dragging from a day's work. And about the only energy we have left is to put ourselves into the easy chair, put our feet up on the hassock, get the remote control, and sit in front of the boob tube glued and take that in. That's pleasure? I don't think that's pleasure. By no means.
With beer or
with
drinks,
a beer, or with food, or with some other means to distract ourselves. We're not a society that is all encourages pleasure. I think we're, in fact, a society that still has a good deal of a Puritan ethic, or in my sense, I'm raised Catholic, and there was always a lot of guilt about feeling good as being Catholic. You're not really not allowed, you're supposed not to feel good.
Jack, it sounds to me like we're talking about perestroika in the USA, that we need a lot of social restructuring and social change in our society. We need a new set of values, a new set of social institutions, social relations, that it's really this competitive stress society, this social Darwinism that's the survival of the fittest, where if you don't make it, there's really no institutions, no safety net, no help to take care of you. It's this individualism gone berserk and amok in our society that's really at the bottom of this drug problem. And if we don't start changing our attitude towards values, towards work, towards everything, as well as our institutions, we're not going to really be able to deal with this drug problem. To begin dealing with the drug problem, we need to talk about new drug treatment programs. We need to have programs out there that will help addicts get off the street, that will help people deal with drug problems. That, to me, it sounds like this also involves psychiatric treatment, counseling, as well as just simply programs like methadone or whatever, education to get people off of drugs.
Well, clearly, if you see drugs as symptomatic, then you look what the problem is. And for me, the problem is, one, it's very easy to get somebody off of drugs. You just put them in a 5-day detox or a 10-day detox, and their body is now clean of the drug.
But that's merely a medical treatment.
That's only a medical treatment, and in fact is only dealing at a symptomatic level. When you put them back in an environment where they don't have opportunity, or an environment where they have lots of stress, or an environment where they have not been able to address a lot of the underlying emotional difficulties they have, then they're going to relapse, they're going to go back. And so you have to begin thinking about this issue in a much more holistic kind of way, in a much more totalistic kind of way than you find policymakers in Washington with very easy sloganeerings about the war on drugs.
You're going to need to rebuild the cities, it seems to me, that the drug cultures are precisely that. It's whole urban ghettos, whole subcultures, where there's nothing but drug use everywhere you look. Until you eliminate these drug subcultures, you're going to have literally millions of people.
This is the problem of the part of the under. This is the problem of the part of the underclass. You see, it's that phrase that's developed in the last 10 years. It used to be, from a class perspective, you had the ruling class, and then you had the working class. And then the American sociology didn't like the concept of a ruling class, so they developed there's an elites, and then there's the middle class, and that's basically all of us are middle class. But the fact is, we now have a group of people who are locked in going nowhere.
Millions
of people who are going nowhere, and really have their life prospects are very dim. And as a political system, we've given up on these people. I mean, the conservatives never really had much hope for them. Edward Banfield, a conservative urbanologist, said years ago that we should think of the city as a sandbox. Mm-hmm. Basically, let's write the cities off. Let's understand that they're basically decadent, and we have nothing we can do for these people. They're hopelessly, pathologically degenerate anyway.
Yes, he said to kind of cordon off the cities, to keep the people in, and then pour toys, like a sandbox, toys, i.e. drugs and things like this, into the cities, keep the people spaced out or occupied, and don't let them out. Mm-hmm. And that way, they wouldn't infect the rest of the society, and you wouldn't have to do anything more about it. It looks like this is kind of what has happened.
Well, the worst part of it is, Frank, is that it's not just the conservatives. Beginning around the mid-1970s with Jimmy Carter, when he began talking about a government of limits, a government where we'd have to lower our expectations, he began saying things like, you cannot expect government to solve our problems. there began a sort of neoliberalism, a sort of fiscal conservatism on the part of liberals that said, listen, we'd love to solve all the problems in the world, but we can't throw money at every problem. And so even liberals, there's no consensus today, as at least we gave lip service to during the Johnson administration of the Great Society, to addressing these problems. We've basically written these people off, and that we've written them off at a time when they cannot help themselves, because one of the issues that no one addresses is a lot of this underclass of people have been rendered technologically obsolete. Their labor is now redundant. The kind of work that my Irish grandfather did when he came from Europe in the turn of the century was to go down to the docks in on the west side of New York and to do what they used to call donkey labor, and you always had the Irish to do donkey labor. And he, with the sweat of his brow and his back, built himself some kind of a life. Today, that job doesn't exist for people. It's been replaced. Those kind of manufacturing and hard labor jobs have been replaced by machinery or have been sent abroad to cheap labor markets. You now have a core of 20 to 25% of the population who literally have no meaningful, well-paying work for. The only thing they have, only prospects they have in front of them is flipping burgers at Wendy's.
Which you can't live on those salaries.
You can't live on those salaries. And then one of the reasons why we're talking about drugs and why people use drugs, but there's a political economy of drugs. Today in New York City, there are sections of New York City that are coming back to life because why? Because the drug money that's infusing a renaissance. Parts of East New York and Queens where the Jamaicans and the rest of the drug gangs are pouring that money back into the community. Actually, Nixon and the Republicans finally got black capitalism, but now it's in the form of the drug economy.
On the other hand, there's other whole parts of the city that are just destroyed.
Yes.
Where the crime, the crack houses, it makes it impossible as a living habitat and impossible to escape that drug culture unless you literally leave it.
And how can you leave it? Now, who has the dollars to leave it? I know a lot of the blacks that I treat as a drug counselor are making a decision to leave and go back south. That's about the only thing. Some of them have relatives down there.
Which is a curious reversal of the earlier patterns.
Exactly. They came north for opportunity, and now they go back for opportunity to live, because New York City and the other urban ghettos just are really uninhabitable at this point. We've been talking about a lot of things. We don't talk about even the crime, what it's like to live in these war zones where innocent people are getting wiped out in these gang wars, these turf wars that are happening in these cities.
Teenage death rates are just incredible. I've read several articles in the Times about this. Jack, one thing we haven't talked about here is the issue of drugs and social control. It seems that obviously that once a certain labor force is obsolete technologically, the society doesn't really care about them. So drugs become a method of social control to keep the underclass down, to keep pacified a potentially restive force. In the 1960s, it was precisely in the urban ghettos that you had blacks, Puerto Ricans, Chicanos, people of all different races and origins were a radical political force. You don't see this anymore. The drug culture has destroyed the radical political subculture that makes one think that they may be people, different groups in this society, may be using drugs as instruments of social control.
Well, you're not the first to bring that up. In fact, Malcolm X, black Muslim leader, I saw a tape just recently of him saying that in 1964. Just before he was assassinated in 65, where he was saying that, we don't own the planes. It's Whitey that's bringing this in. It's a way for us to be chilled out. It's a way for us to be pacified. It's a way for our people to be narcotized. I mean, I don't know if there's any conscious cabal, conspiratorial clique at the top that is sort of crafty enough to divine this pretty malevolent technique of social control. But it's certainly, whether or not it's by design, it certainly works out that way.
And a lot of people I've read and talked to people who say that during the urban riots of the 60s and 70s, that suddenly there was an enormous infusion of drugs from the outside to cool them off. Now, that had to be something that was planned and controlled.
No, you know what I think it is, Frank? I don't see it as that. I think that there's so much money at stake when it comes to drugs that, I mean, just think back to Serpico, the example of Serpico, the cop in New York, tried to be an honest cop, right? There's so much drug money floating around at the end of the 60s and the 70s, is that basically everybody can get bought off. Everybody can get a piece of the action. So it may look, in fact, that everyone is approving of it and that at the top is basically calling the shots, the people at the top calling the shots. But it really is that there's so much money that almost nobody is immune to being bought off and bribed. And so it looks like, well, the whole community is getting infested. Who's there to do the job? Who's there to stop it from coming in? The police can be bought. These kind of dollars they're talking about are a lot of money.
But Jack, the facts of the matter are that, one, it's been tolerated for several decades. Heavy drug use in the ghettos and other parts of the United States have been tolerated despite the war on drugs that Nixon, Reagan, Bush, and other right-wingers have declared. They really haven't done anything. Okay, they have.
What would you like them to do?
Well, let's talk about this.
What would you have liked them to do? Would you like them to start locking people up? Nixon done that.
Well, the point is, they haven't done the things that we're talking about to get at the origin of the drug problem.
Right,
that is poverty, ghetto life, etc.
They have a different ideology. They have different stakes. They have different. They have a different agenda. They have privilege to protect. They have their power to protect. There's old ideologies built into America that if, you know, if you can make it, you can make it on your own. Even if you come up in the lowest of circumstances through hard work and ambition, you can rise up by your own bootstraps. I mean, this is not a culture that sort of looks out for the weak. This is not a culture that, you know, sheds too many tears about the poor. I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that they're not looking into arrangements, social arrangements, which they see as part of nature. I mean, they don't think that this is class oppression. They think this is life. Yeah, in life there's winners and there's losers. We're sorry, but some people have to lose. That's capitalism.
But I think it's important to see that really the war on drugs, as declared by Bush, and all of the right-wing solutions to the drug problems are just simply pseudo-solutions that really can't work and don't work. Let's take the project of getting drugs at the source. We hear a lot about the Colombia cocaine cartel. Mm-hmm. We talk about using U.S. troops to go down to Colombia and South America and destroy drugs at the source. Why do you think this is a pseudo solution to it and really sort of a smokescreen over the whole
problem? Did you read my mind? You thought you knew it was a pseudo solution? How do you know that I don't think it's a terrific idea?
Well, because we talked about this before, for one thing.
Well, actually, I don't think it's much of a solution. I think, in fact, there's a tendency in the part of American culture to always look for outside agitators to blame.
Right.
Always look for, to externalize the problem. Think of some bad apples in the barrel. In other words, American system is basically a good barrel. We've got a few bad apples, and if we can get rid of the bad apples, we've got a basically good institutional arrangements here. So it's easy to blame, you know, the drug cartel and General Noriega and the Contras and cocaine production. Just as we blame the Turks, Nixon blamed the Turks in Turkey for the heroin production, or the Cambodians and the Laotians and the Thais for the Golden Triangle production back in the 60s and 70s. Frankly, I think really it's diversionary. Because 5 years from now, maybe even 2 years from now, we will not be talking about cocaine. Cocaine will be passé. Like good old American know-how and technology, we are now replacing natural products with synthetic products. The markets of the drugs of the future are going to be synthetic, man-made, made in clandestine secret laboratories by high school chemists are going to be able to make money. I see it now as drugs like ice and ecstasy and crank. These are all synthetic drugs, much more powerful and in many ways much more deadly than the natural products. So, and again, my argument is, why be focusing on Noriega and the Contras and the drug cartels? The reality is what is it about American culture that leaves us so ripe to want to use drugs?
I think there's a very important factor here, and that is that you were talking about Reagan and Bush and the right-wingers, well, even Jimmy Carter. This is very important for them to keep this drug thing going. As the big study group out in California a few years ago with the police from all over the country, they said, hey, we don't want to eliminate crime because then we'd be out of a job. So we got to keep enough of this going to keep our, just like the vice squads. They don't want to eliminate vice in town. They wouldn't have anything to do. They'd be out of a job. So you got to keep it going. But the people, the Reagans and the Bushes of the world, they want to use this so-called war on drugs. They don't want to stop it. Bush was in charge of interdiction of drugs, spent billions of dollars during the Reagan administration, and drug importation has only increased. But you know what you see? They're using the drug war on drugs to curtail civil liberties of ordinary people or maybe just casual users. They also are using it as a method of mucking around in the third world. I noticed that the president of Colombia, when the Americans sent different types of military armaments down there to fight against the Colombian drug cartels, he said, hey, wait a minute. This isn't the type of equipment we need to fight the drug cartels, but it's perfect if you want to use it against the left-wing insurgent guerrillas. And the same thing I noticed in Peru and Bolivia. When the Americans go down there, advisors, they're down there under the, supposedly, to fight drugs. But what are they doing? They're not fighting the drug lords and all. They're after the left-wing guerrillas who are trying to overthrow the governments, who won't say no.
Well, that's the thing.
So there are a lot of agendas and excuses that they've got to keep this drug war going.
Well, that's the thing I like about alternative views. Never ask leading questions on this show.
Jack, I have another leading question for you. A lot of the liberals and libertarians, in response to this right-wing war on drugs, do they see is repressive of our civil liberties and as extending an interventionist foreign policy, they say, hey, let's just legalize it. Right. We'll get rid of organized crime and the criminalization of drugs. We can solve the prison problem. There's tons of people in prison that cost, as you said earlier, $50,000 a day for the state to take care of. Why don't we just decriminalize drugs? If some people want to destroy themselves, okay. We can use some of the money from the profits from drugs for rehabilitation programs for other people that want to get off drugs. What's wrong with this libertarian legalization argument?
They also say that the price will go down on drugs, and therefore that the addicts, the people who use them, won't have to go on Mother's Day beat up on the ladies and little old ladies who are getting their welfare checks or their Social Security checks. Mm-hmm. They won't have to prostitute themselves in order to get money because the price will be low.
So all the problems of drugs will be solved by legalization, right?
No, I think what you'll solve with legalization, and on the face of it, it's a fairly attractive and it's a very tightly reasoned article, thesis. I think what you'll do is you'll probably have a decrease in property crimes, which, of course, if you have property, is always very, people are interested in doing if you have property. And Milton Friedman and William F. Buckley and a number of conservatives have put this forward as a means to deal with the drug problem. They're not talking about the drug problem. They're really talking about the crime problem.
Well, actually, not property. I mean, people getting mugged in the streets.
Well, yes. That's the way.
Bodies are front piece of property.
Yeah. I think that's the cover. I think that's the cover story. I really think that these, from a practical standpoint, legalization is a complete mess. Let me just pose it to you. We have laws now in this country, in every state, that says if you're a bartender, you cannot serve an inebriated or an intoxicated person. In fact, in places like New York, you have liquor law liability, which says if you serve an intoxicated person that last drink and that person goes out and has an accident, you are responsible for the damages. You can be sued. Now I would ask you, if we were to have state-supported drug clinics, actually state-supported crack houses, and somebody came in and wanted to get high, at what point would you tell them that they had enough? Listen, fella, you've had enough. You can't have any more. Do you know what it's like to tell somebody who's been using cocaine or crack, you've had enough and you're not going to have any more? First of all, you're going to have cops right in there, because to restrain this person when he goes nuts and says, I want more, you're not going to stop me. But let's say that he has, and you give him an hour's worth of drugs, or 2 hours worth of drugs, or 3 hours worth of drugs. How about the fact that we know that one single use of cocaine can cause a heart attack, as it did for Len Bias, the basketball star who was drafted by the Boston Celtics. He died right out, one single use of cocaine. He was a healthy man, especially now what we're learning about cocaine and blood, how it interrupts blood flow to the heart. Are you going to give people enough drugs to let them kill themselves? If they kill themselves, is the state going to be responsible? Who's going to be held responsible when they do that? Are you going to allow pregnant women to get drugs in these state-supported crack houses or drug dens? Because we know what the effects are on the fetus of the drugs. We know that a single use of cocaine can stroke a fetus, can break the placenta open, and they can bleed to death in the womb. We're going to allow pregnant women to have it? At what age are we going to stop people from going in? Is it going to be 14, 16, 18, 21? For those people who you don't allow into your state-supported crack houses or legalized drug dens, where can they go? They'll go to a black market. The black market will still exist for the youth, for pregnant women, for those people you don't allow to have any more than their ration. I think it's a complete folly. And I think if we as political people, I'm not just a drug counselor, I'm still wearing a political hat, we should understand that this is basically has an agenda. It's part of the final solution to the underclass.
The legalization.
The legalization. Keep them under a chemical yoke for the rest of their natural lives, and those lives will be much shorter. And by the way, when you talk about crime will be go down, having grown up as a child of an alcoholic, I know that the kind of devastation that a person under the influence can do to children, unto the loved ones around them. What do you think these people who are getting high at state-supported crack houses, what are they going to do when they go home to their families and loved ones? Can you imagine what life is going to be like driving in cars? It's bad enough that 50,000 people get killed on the highways from drugs. What is life going to be like when you know that the guy who's driving alongside of you in the next lane has just come out of a crack house? I think life will be much more explosive, much more dangerous, much worse. I don't want to see people have freer, much more accessible, hassle-free drugs. I think we just need to be dealing with root causes, and legalization doesn't deal with root causes. Legalization just deals with the symptom. They want drugs, we'll give them more drugs. Just leave us alone. If you want to kill yourself, go right ahead. It's none of our business.
But criminalization hasn't worked either, as we've seen. Plus, as we talked about at the very first of the program a long time ago, Homo sapien and other animals have used psychoactive substances ever since they've been in existence. So you have a contradiction here, do you not, about how are you going to prohibit, on one hand, criminalize something which seems to be inherent in the human species, the desire for some type of psychoactive experience.
The desire I think that human beings have is a desire for pleasure, a desire for belonging, a desire for meaning and purpose in their life, a desire to be connected to other human beings in a meaningful way, a desire to maybe have an out-of-mind experience. Yes, to experience pleasure and excitement. Sure, these folks are tense, but we have other means for people to reduce tension. There's meditation, there's all kinds of, there's massage, there's relaxation devices. We can be teaching people, we can be building into the culture means other than chemical to help people deal with their emotional problems. I don't think that, yes, criminalization hasn't worked. That's one of the strongest pieces of those who argue for legalization, is that criminalization doesn't work. I'm absolutely in agreement it doesn't work. But legalization would only make things worse.
Jack, what about making a distinction between those drugs that are known to be destructive and harmful?
Yes.
And let us say cocaine. The latest surveys on cocaine mm-hmm. do indicate they can bring heart attacks about.
Yes.
Crack, we know, is addictive and destructive, which is a cocaine
right.
derivative.
Mm-hmm.
Can we isolate as a society what drugs are definitely harmful and destructive? Let us say cocaine, heroin, crack, etc.
Alcohol.
Serious, alcohol yeah. is a seriously destructive.
Well, I guess what you left,
product.
I mean, listen, what
yeah.
you're left with is one of the problems
yeah,
with legalization. One of the problems is with legalization is that you literally might be able to technically legalize heroin, because a heroin addict could, might get off 2 or 3 times a day, but a cocaine addict gets off 6 times an hour.
But is this a solution? Legalize marijuana, legalize even heroin and some of these other new chemicals, these synthetics, that, maybe aren't destructive in the same way that crack, cocaine, etc. are. So you provide some pleasurable, anxiety-reducing experiences for people.
Well, we do prescribe drugs in our society. I mean, doctors prescribe drugs. I mean, pharmaceutical houses are the biggest pushers of drugs in the United States. I mean, we have a commercial that says, for Nuprin, I think it says, when you haven't got time for the pain.
Well, is marijuana any, say, more destructive than alcohol, tobacco, or Valium, or some of the chemical drugs that are sold over the counter, for one example?
Well, for one example, it's clear that the people that I know who use marijuana habitually, that they definitely have memory loss. They definitely have short-term memory loss. And
what do you say?
Now you're up to your old tricks. So is memory loss, they believe there's issues of sterility. They think there may be changes in I hypothesize that there may be changes in the genetic structure from marijuana. I think the jury is still out about using marijuana. If I had to rank order right. in terms of danger, no, marijuana doesn't rank in. In fact, when I go out into the high schools, I can't tell the kids that all drugs are harmful, all drugs are destructive. I think I'm doing a disservice. I have to make distinctions. If they're going to use drugs, there are some drugs that are a lot worse than others. There are some drugs that are a lot more destructive than others.
But in terms of legalization, you're not willing to say that any of the drug laws should be changed. You see it more as a societal problem of getting into the sources, the causes of what leads people.
I think you're only feeding the habit. You're not really getting to the source. And by the way, we're interested as radicals in politicizing people, in getting them active, in being involved in their community. I can tell you from personal experience that drugs is not an empowering. It cripples people. Drugs does not build community, it destroys community. Drugs is not something that we as people who are thinking about broader political change should be advocating, because all it really serves to do is basically narcotize people and seduce them into accepting the way that things are as they are.
Do you think that we should recriminalize the use of alcohol and make the use of tobacco products illegal?
Listen, if I had my druthers, people wouldn't drink. But see, I'd have to make a distinction. There are obviously people who can integrate alcohol, a couple of drinks or so, into their life, and it does not have destructive, negative consequences.
Well, you could say the same thing about taking a couple of puffs of marijuana or maybe a snort of cocaine.
Well, I suppose you can, and in fact, there are people who use cocaine that way. The profile of person that I laid out to you, people who come from highly dysfunctional families, who really never get to feel good except when they use chemicals, those people are very vulnerable. I mean, if you're talking about people who in their life have assets to fall back on, I don't mean just financial assets, but they have supportive family, loving friends, they have a decent job, they have a nice place to live. Sure, they may in fact, I guess it's technically possible, they could have drugs, they could integrate it into their lives, it's something they might do once in a while recreationally. But if you have people who have nothing else to look forward in their life except drugs as a means to feel good, to feel better, at least temporarily, that's a powerful, seductive idea, isn't it?
And yet as laws now, and the way they're using these laws, they want to throw all of these people into prison. both groups, the casual user, they're not doing harm to themselves.
I don't think they mean that war. I've been very observant of the policy making, drug making policy in the last few years. There has been a right-wing agenda basically to use drugs for pretty much locking up about a third of the population. I think if some of these guys had their way, they were talking about for a while shooting down planes that they suspected of carrying drugs, drug smuggling. They were talking about locking up first-time users. They were talking about the death penalty for pushers, making no distinction between most users are oftentimes dealers, if the only way to cut down on their overhead. They were talking about throwing families of users out of federal housing. In other words, you might be a mother raising six kids, and your teenage son sells drugs and is caught. The whole family gets thrown out of federal housing. That was Jack Kemp's idea. Well, that didn't go through the Congress. You know, we shouldn't be sort of clumsy about the way we talk about politics in Washington. There are people in Washington who are fighting a civil libertarian position, who are basically trying to see drugs in a broader context, are trying to get treatment for addicts, are trying to deal with this on a more preventive basis. I think so far they've been able to fight off this right-wing agenda, which is quite anti-civil libertarian in its import.
But some of the people pushing these obnoxious proposals mm-hmm. are people like George Bush and William Bennett, who are two of the highest authorities in this country in the so-called war on drugs. So we have to be very vigilant of what their latest program is going to be. We haven't even mentioned this drug testing, that there's been a lot of trial balloons about testing anyone who has a federal job. Ed Meese, when he was Attorney General, was telling employers they should give drug tests to all their employees. Anyone that doesn't pass is fired. They should have checks mm-hmm. in the locker rooms, in mm-hmm. the parking lots, mm-hmm. etc. So there's very serious attempts to carry out a war on drugs. It'll be a war on civil liberties in this country by the right wing. So far, the liberals have more or less kept most of these extreme right-wing projects.
Well, there's also liberals, but there's also one shouldn't forget there's also conservatives who have fears of a strong Big Brother state. So there's an alliance among liberals and conservatives in its traditional sense about not wanting to see the growth of state power as a check on this unleashed anti-civil libertarian fervor.
But there's also liberals who go along with conservatives on some of their social programs.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
if the war on drugs becomes hysterical, if there's some major murders, let us say, mm-hmm. through drug abuse, etc., it's conceivable Congress could pass some extremely repressive drug laws. So I think this is a very dangerous and very tense issue for this country. And until we do come with more humane and more rational perspectives on the whole drug problem, this could easily be something that conservative or even liberal politicians could manipulate in very pernicious ways.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that it's clear from watching the circus for several years now is that drugs are a political football. I mean, it's a very it's a winner of an issue as a politician to run on. After all, who is overtly going to come out and say, I'm for drugs?
You can't be soft on drugs. It's like you couldn't be soft on communism.
There's no cost to being a drug warrior. But in the same time it's been a political football, I think that the discussion, the way the terms of the debate have been framed, have depoliticized the issue. By only talking about a war on drugs, the public discussion has been over the tactics of the war. Should we go down to Colombia? Should we extradite the leaders? Should we destroy the crops? Should we lock up users? Should we be executing pushers? Should we be throwing people out of federal housing? Should we have mandatory testing? But this emphasis on tactic has obscured a much more fundamental examination, a much more introspective approach that would look at what are the underlying assumptions of the war. And basically both the Democratic and Republican parties have been war parties in this matter. They both have been advocating a much more stringent attack on drugs than looking at it in a much more holistic and larger contextual understanding. They really have not been for that. And that's essentially what we need. And we're not getting that kind of discussion from either of the major parties.
We turn now to some news stories, which we have gleaned from the alternative press.
Two publications, one the Spotlight and the other the Guardian, which have articles about the cover-up which is going on in the Noriega trial. Seems like the government is really doing its best to try to keep out as much information on certain specific subjects, particularly those that will link George Bush with Noriega and also the CIA and its narcotics running activities of bringing some of this dope back into the United States, particularly cocaine. You remember we had a story about Operation Watchtower, in which it was a CIA-run operation, in which there were various beacons set up in Panama and Colombia in order to guide planes out of Colombia into Panama, where they would bring cocaine, and then the cocaine would be taken to a U.S. Air Force base and back in the United States. Well, on July 27th of 91, the Spotlight found out that the prosecutors were frantically attempting to keep any information on Operation Watchtower from being revealed. And also, there are two other particular things which they're trying to keep quiet. One is the relationship between Vice President George Bush, then Vice President George Bush, and Noriega, because there were some photographs that were the defense was trying to get put into evidence, but this was denied by the judge. Then there was information about a close relationship between Noriega and the Israelis. And when it came down to trying to specify just what information, services Panama may have performed for Israel, the prosecutors objected, and they had a hush-hush conference with the judge, and then the inquiries were dropped. So those are three areas which the Spotlight says are being covered up. Now, the material that was being covered up by The Guardian was talked about in their August 28th edition. It said that the large amounts of cocaine which were smuggled into Florida with U.S. government protection in order to help finance the Contras was the subject of a Mexico City newspaper report. It was a 107-page document that was very heavily censored, which they got. And it showed that Panamanian dictator Noriega had significant contacts with then Vice President George Bush, actually further back than that, for the past 15 years. And it hints that the invasion of Panama was supposed to kill Noriega to try to hush him up. This was in the newspaper La Jornada in Mexico. Well, the New York Times just dismissed this as impossible to verify, although this is consistent with a lot of other information which has come out about the relationships between Noriega and Bush all along. The section of the document concerning the Reagan administration's plan to overthrow the Sandinistas was really quite heavily mutilated by the censorship. But it describes the CIA-supported air operations that ferried arms to the Contras and smuggled cocaine on the way back. Well, this is nothing new. If you've been watching Alternative News, you know that. Now, the section most censored concerns the contacts between Noriega and Bush, which began back in 1976 when Bush was head of the CIA. Many of the sections of the document dealing with Noriega's tie with Casey, who was head of the CIA, and Oliver North, and Bush were all deleted by the censors. So there's a lot of censoring going on that the people down there in Miami, the government folks, don't want you to find out all George Bush's relationships. Now, the Miami Herald had an article about another interesting twist that was going on. You remember that North and had as his buddies the dictatorship, the brutal dictatorship in Argentina. They were helping to train people to send the Contras down into Nicaragua, and they were helping with the death squad activity and all. Well, it seems that this
they got so tight that when the Falklands were, the Falklands War, British and the Argentinians, Argentinians, well, the Oliver North folks, particularly Oahu himself, were afraid that his buddies, the Argentinians, were going to lose. And so he made sure they had some Exocet missiles. And you remember, it was the Exocet missiles which helped sink the British ships. In a rather surprise move, on August 7th, the judge ordered the government to release secret documents pertaining to the case, which reportedly deal with the CIA and the Drug Enforcement Agency, and all of these, their operations, which allowed safe passage of these planes, which were carrying drugs. Panama's aides to the Contras, and a lot of other information, which the judge says he wants to see. So, it's really curious. The judge is coming in and demanding some information, but when there's too much objection or it gets too close to George Bush, then the judge cuts it off. So, we'll see if Noriega does have a get-out-of-jail-free card after all, or maybe it's a trip to the morgue if he does get out.
According to a report I got out of PeaceNet, there's fear in the Soviet Union emerging concerning the beginnings of a populist dictatorship organized around one Boris Yeltsin, who was presented in the mass media in the United States, of course, as the hero of the Russian attempt to destroy the coup d'etat that happened a month or so ago. Well, according to this PeaceNet information, as the coup by the 8-person state committee for the state of emergency began to unravel on August the 22nd, Yeltsin issued a series of decrees placing all central state institutions, including the mass media and the military forces of the Soviet Union, under his control. Yeltsin's bid to control all the union organization has provoked angry responses from presidents and members of other republics in the Soviet Union. One of the presidents of another republic, Nazarbayev, said that the Russian government's great power chauvinist attitude was driving other republics out of the Soviet Union. Everyone is afraid, he said. Nazarbayev was particularly incensed by a statement by Yeltsin that if the Soviet Union broke up, the borders of the states would not be the present ones. They would have to take into account ethnic Russians and where they live, Yeltsin said. This threat was repeated by his press secretary, who said that the lines on our maps are not real boundaries. They're just lines on maps. In the Ukraine, for instance, in the Donbas coal-producing area and the Crimea, both of them have large Russian populations, as does northern Kazakhstan, and many of the other republics have a lot of ethnic Russians. And the implication is that Russia might take over territory from a lot of the other republics if these lines on the maps were redrawn in order to keep all of the ethnic Russians into one great Russia. Then that would just be chauvinism in the behalf of Russia, the state of Russia that Yeltsin's the president of, that would just replace one dictatorship, i.e. the Soviet Union, with another, i.e. Russia. So there's a lot of fear of Yeltsin in the Soviet Union that he may be on a power grab.
So you think the Cold War is over and we should do away with a lot of the missiles and not build any new ones? Well, that isn't in the plans of the big guys. For several years, the people in the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission are saying, hey, we got to have a lot of missiles, we've got to have ICBMs, we've got to have Star Wars, regardless of what happens in the real world. Well, in Congress, the Senate Armed Services Committee, by a vote of 16-4, approved the latest in a big package for the Pentagon, and it's the latest metamorphosis of the Star Wars thing. It's a ground-based missile defense system, they call it. The first six of what would eventually be deployed to cover the 48 states plus Hawaii and Alaska. Now, such weapons in the past have always been really characterized by the peace movement as first strike weapons, and that is why These are prohibited by the Soviet Union and the United States when they agreed to the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. However, those in Congress now and in the White House are saying, well, we just ignore that or scrap the treaty completely. But still, the people up there in Washington are not asking any basic questions. If the Soviet Union is no longer a threat, why build all this expensive stuff, which a lot of scientists say won't work anyway? The United States continues to test the nuclear weapons underground, and even the Soviet Union suspended those, and the U.S. is the only country that signed the test ban treaty that continues to do this. So it looks like the old orthodox thinking in Washington is still existing, according to the article in The Progressive, and what is needed is for a total test ban against these nonsense missile defense systems be implemented immediately.
Frank, World Perspectives magazine has some stories of some information that I hadn't heard about Central America and Chile. In Nicaragua, evidently the Contras are reorganizing and have been systematically killing people in the country. Three children and two adults were killed by rearmed Contras in a village 90 kilometers from northwest Managua in early September. Nicaragua radio also reported that four peasants were wounded and 10 were kidnapped, and their houses were burnt down by former rearmed Contras. And there's a real problem in dealing with these rearmed Contras because the military of Nicaragua has scaled itself down and is now the smallest in Central America. So General Humberto Ortega, the former Sandinista who is now in charge of the military, said that he's going to form some rural commandos to help organize the people in the countryside to ensure their security of people that are in the countryside against the rearmed Contras, as well as against cattle thieves and drug trafficking. So it looks like in Nicaragua there's a danger of another Contra war.
There's a story that was first broken in the Dallas newspaper and later picked up by the Associated Press. The Dallas Morning News said that almost 450 people have died in Texas in the jails or during arrests. And who's killed them? Well, the state law enforcement officials. That 450 is from the present time, November of 1991, going back to 1987. And no criminal action was taken in 99% of the deaths. And more than 60% of these people died in jail. The majority of natural causes, plus suicide. Sometimes suicide, sometimes, well, maybe, quotation mark, suicides. The Morning News put it this way. Every 4 days, a person dies at the hands of Texas law enforcement officials. Some people don't see this as a problem. For instance, Rhonda Lord of the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas said that the dramatically low indictment and conviction rate of police officers shows that only a handful of these cases warrant scrutiny. And then we come to his wonderful quote, which gives you insight into Texas culture. You hire police officers to deal with violent people and to forcibly arrest people, even if it means taking their lives. The Lord continued, you use whatever force is deemed necessary to bring a person into custody, even if you have to kill him. Oh, yeah.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We also can provide you with some information on how to get some of the publications of former CIA officer John Stockwell. We'd like to thank our crew, Eric Eubank and Kevin L. West, for the interview, and Brian Lynch for the news. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.